Hiya, Tim Burgess here with a message before the podcast. Due to rights reasons, the songs have been shortened for this podcast. Every song is taken from Travis's The Man Who. All tracks are written by Fran Healy. The Man Who was released on 24th of May 1999 on Independiente. Now, enjoy the podcast.
Tim's listening party was a lockdown sensation.
Unfortunately, it was on Twitter, which you can't listen to.
But Absolute Radio has the solution.
Tim Burgess explores seminal albums alongside the artists who brought them to life.
Absolute Radio presents Tim's Listening Party with Tim Burgess.
Hiya, and welcome to another episode of Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. I'm Tim Burgess, and I'm excited to be sitting down with another band to play back a classic album together. If you've missed any episodes of the show, The Libertines, Def Leppard, Sparks, Texas, Catatonia, Fallout Boy, The Kinks, U2, make sure you catch up by searching for Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. I love hearing from you, so get involved on Twitter by tweeting at Tim_Burgess and at Absolute Radio using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. This episode, I'm joined by a band whose music, at the turn of the century, helped to define the British alternative music sound that followed. The Man Who is one of the most successful British albums of the last 25 years. The Man Who spent 11 weeks at number one, a further 134 weeks in the top 100. Going 9 times platinum in the UK, it sold 3.5 million copies worldwide. The album garnered critical recognition with 2 Ivor Novello Awards and 2 Brit Awards for the Best British Band and Best British Album, and led to them headlining Glastonbury in 2000 alongside David Bowie. 2024 is a big year for the band. They'll be releasing their 10th studio album, LA Times, on July the 12th, with the lead single Gaslight, as well as celebrating 25 years of The Man Who. It's Travis. Do you want to start with Gaslight?
So, what I want to say before I start, this is really exciting for me because you and your band were a big part of when I was, you know, coming up.
Uh-huh.
Before I went to art school. So I've got slight starstruck nervousness meeting you. Honestly,
oh, man.
It's just, I know, but it's, okay. I know you might be like, oh, it's only me, but it's lovely to meet you.
It's lovely to meet you
and
too.
Thank you for being an amazing band, and you're a band's band, which is what we all want. It's the best band you can be is the band's band, where other bands are like, so
that's
thank
very
you
kind.
So right, okay. Once I get that out of the way,
thank
I can
you
move
so
on.
Yeah, that's so sweet.
Okay, so Gaslight, I read a couple of weeks ago that it's the most searched for word. I didn't know that when I wrote it.
Right.
Like, I don't sit down and go, right, I'm gonna write about this, you know. Yeah. You just fiddle around with a guitar or a piano and then out comes stuff and you sort of spodge it together. Mm-hmm. And then you have a song.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know anyone that hasn't been gaslit.
Yeah.
Some more than others. I seem to attract it, and I think artists more than anyone seem to attract it, because we're kind of children of our time, you know. We're quite innocent.
Yeah.
And we're surrounded by this business that is quite exploitative.
Uh-huh.
You know, listening to that lassie Ray talking about her experience in the industry is, I know a lot of artists who that chimes with their experience. But I think whether you're in a classroom or whether you're in a boardroom or whether you're looking at the news and listening to politicians kind of warping our realities, it's something that's very prevalent today. And I think the song speaks to that. And the song actually speaks to going to try and get away from, you know, because life's too short. I'm 50 now. When you get to 50, you go, you know what? I need to spring clean. Because,
yeah,
you know, someone said this great thing. They're like, if you're with someone, if you're on the phone with someone and you come off the phone, or whenever you meet that person and you don't feel that good after meeting them,
yeah,
you shouldn't be, you know, just move away from them. You know, just kind of get your space and have a happier life. So there's loads of that in this song. It's like a celebration of going, come on. And also saying to all the bullies out there, like, I've got your number, or we've got your number. So that's kind of what it's about.
When you first heard the lyric and stuff, how did it feel to you, Dougie?
You sent a demo of it, right?
Mm.
And I was like, oh, that's good. I was kind of like, this is, I like this.
It's great when you know that, isn't it?
Yeah, I just was like, well, kind of melodically, I was like, that's quality melody. But lyrically, it was like, yeah, this feels like it's coming from a genuine place,
yeah,
it's coming
yeah,
from
yeah,
an honest place, which is kind of, that's the first box you ticks, oh, this is a good song. It feels honest and feels authentic.
Yeah.
And it was just like, oh, this is a thing. This is a thing. You know, when you feel, I guess, when you listen to demos, it's kind of, they're quite often quite nascent, quite kind of, you know, nebulous, I was going to say, not rubbish, but this one was like, it was partially formed, but it felt like it was all there, you know.
And how does the demo arrive? Is it kind of like, have you got a studio, or is it voice memo? Or
no, I got a MIDI keyboard because my MIDI keyboard broke, and so I got a new MIDI keyboard. I took it out of the box, plugged it in at the computer, and the first thing I played was the chords this is a constant sort of like loop of that chord, and that was it, and I wrote the song into 10 minutes. And I'm
fantastic.
Clay came in, my son came in, and he'd been dealing with a lot of this at school, having a real hard time at school, so there's a little bit of him in it as well.
How old?
He was 16 at the time. He's 18 now. He's just about to turn 17 at the time. He was like, that's great, Papa. And then when it was all done and finished and I played it to him, he's like, that's the best thing you've ever done, Papa.
Oh, that's
and great. It's,
it was really interesting because my kid's like, Freddie's 16, and he was like, that's brilliant to Gaslight. And it was like, it seemed to really chime with that kind of age, you know. It's interesting.
Perfect. So we're going to talk about The Man Who.
Yes.
Do you remember any of it?
I've got so many memories. I could talk all day about it.
Do you remember like where you were before going in to write, record, anything?
Well, the first song that we had for The Man Who was Writing to Reach You. But we had that before we even came to London in 1996.
Yeah.
I wrote it in 95, day after Christmas, Boxing Day. There's a song on our first album called The Line Is Fine, which I wrote, and then 20 minutes later wrote Writing to Reach You right after it.
Wow.
I just split up with my girlfriend, Katrina, and someone gave me this book of letters from Franz Kafka to this woman called Phyllis, called Letters to Phyllis, and it's all his letters to this woman who he hardly ever, I don't think he ever even met her, but he was the love of his life that he never met. But they're all just one way, there's no replies. It's just this one-way thing. And at the time, I'd been writing lots of letters to Katrina because she'd just moved to St Andrews, the university, and her relationship was beginning to dissolve as she went on with her life. And I was kind of like stuck on the dole, going nowhere, feeling really crap.
Wow.
And then she chucked me, and I was just heartbroken. And so the song spoke to that thing. And reading this book at the time of this guy writing to this person, and that's all you... like I was doing at the time, just writing all these letters and never quite being able to reach the person.
I mean, if you don't mind me saying, this song does sound like the beginning of a heartbreak album.
It's the split up part. It's a real breakup record.
Yeah.
Maybe not, like, Why Is It Always Raining? Means it's almost nothing to do with it.
Right,
Because it was just that song that was written after the event. But the majority of that record, Writing to Reach You, Love, there's a song called Love on it.
Yeah.
Was
that written around about then as well? Mm-hmm.
That was written a couple of months before that, because she'd gone away, and I wrote this whole, you know, What's So Wrong, Why the Face song, You Leaving, and I made this beautiful demo of it. I've still got the demo of it. I'm not one to go, that's great. But this, from a distance, it's a really, really fragile, beautiful demo that way better than the version on the album. Pure demo items.
Yeah.
And I sent it to her, and she never ever replied. And I was like, oh,
that was my
best shot, you know. And it never came. She dropped the penny down the well, and
throwing out my best gold at you.
So the album's got a lot of that, and it's about maybe 60-70% that breakup that completely destroyed me at the time. But like all A&R guys, I remember Andy McDonald. Did you ever meet Andy Mack?
I think so. Independiente.
That's
right.
Andy was always joking, like when an artist splits up with their girlfriend, they're like, oh, yes.
Yes, here we go.
Fantastic. I wrote, setting the scene, claustrophobic, repetitive, recognising objects like the radio and what it was playing.
Yeah.
Questioning everything. There's an oddness. Outside is inside, right side is on the left. That's the lyric, right? Is it?
Yeah,
I mean, the sound of it, it's like really open, and it sort of like allows, you know, the lyric and the sentiment to really come across beautifully, I think.
Yeah, it's weird that the inside is outside, right side on the left side. When I was a little boy, I was terrorised at school. I lived in the hardest, it was the heroin capital of Glasgow, in Postle Park, and I got really badly bullied at school. Like, I was just talking to my mum about it, to the point where we had to move. Whenever that happened to me, I'd get this weird sensation of my body feeling like I was being corkscrewed or twisted. Wow. My legs were, my left leg felt like my right leg, and it was the weirdest feeling. And,
terrifying.
Yeah, when someone's coming at you and you're fearing for, you're kind of having this existential sort of, oh, at the age of eight, like every day.
It's like a freeze response almost, yeah. Like to trauma.
Super. But so that was that. That's that line. Everything, wow. It's like everything in that album's pretty raw and pretty, not even pretty honest, it's totally honest. And I think that's why, even now, if I listen to it, I'm like, oh, you know, if the truth was a bell, it would ring forever.
So, lads, let's hear the first track from The Man Who. It's Writing to Reach You. Writing to Reach You by Travis, the first song from The Man Who. Track two, The Fear. Mm-hmm. It's got this like arpeggiator kind of guitar at the beginning, and sort of funk style thing. And
that was the first song we recorded with
Nigel. Wow. I mean, I like the juxtaposition of the, you know, the funk style guitar going into then the acoustic.
So there's a bit at the beginning in that song that goes.
And
I had to go back and get a glockenspiel from the house. I'd left the studio. I just wasn't there. And when I came back, I'm always there. Mr. Just like watching what's going on. But I had to go and get it. I came back and this... Brr, brr, I was like, what is this? It sounds amazing. And then again, we were back in Rack Studios like maybe 15 years later. And we found the Juno, that actual Juno.
Oh, wow.
We plugged it in, and I'd always been really, really curious about, like, the sound and what the, and it was the first preset. It was one of those.
Andy Dunlop basically pressed the first button.
Yeah, yeah.
And Nigel went, that sounds great, let's do that.
Yeah. I've had that with an Omnicord.
So The Fear was... If you listen to it, that the drum sound on that, I think it's one of the best drum sounds we've ever recorded. I think Nigel as well has ever recorded. You know when you're in the studio, and you'll know this, you put your headphones on, generally the mix you get in a studio is not so good, right? You know, you go along and then you go in and listen to it. When you're working with Nigel, his headphone mix is like, it's amazing.
Wow.
I was like, where's the... This is coming over from here, and he's able to. I don't know how he does it, but it was. Remember, just and I'm like, that's a completely live track. I've got the multi-track, so when we went back in to get little samples, I managed to get the 24 tracks.
Wow!
And you can hear on the acoustic track the actual vocal. So the vocal's live. There's no overdubbing. The whole thing, that whole song's live.
I mean, you have to get a really good sound in your headphones to be able to do that, right?
Yeah.
It was so good in the headphones at times, it was quite disconcerting because you're thinking you're already listening to a record.
Right.
As you're kind of playing it. And so you kind of feel like you could stop playing.
And it would
carry on.
So you have to get used to it before you can sort of like get a handle on it.
Exactly. It was really interesting. Wow. It's very weird.
I noticed you mastered from the triple rhyme, which I'm quite a big fan of.
What's that?
The triple rhyme. It was like the fear is coming clear, my dear.
Oh.
You know, and I'm a big fan of that.
Closer every year, so near.
I spoke to, I think it was Martin Fry about it.
Uh-huh.
I had ABC in here a couple of days ago.
Wow.
And he was talking about the triple rhyme, and you know, I picked up on that.
As an aside, you're meeting all these people that are just, and you're getting to, I think what this project is so good, because these songs are going to be around forever, but the artists aren't going to be around forever, and you've now recorded them for posterity, talking about these things that would be lost otherwise. You know, it's great. And you get to meet like some of these amazing heroes that we watched on Top of the Pops when we were like 12, going,
you know, Martin Fry, it was really great.
And he's a fan of the triple rhyme too.
He's a fan of the triple rhyme.
The triple rhyme. I didn't even know there was such a thing until you told me. So
right.
Favorite one is an REM one where he goes, "I'm Steve McQueen, I'm Jimmy Dean, I'm Martin Sheen." He must have been delighted when he got to Martin Sheen. He
I hate comparing sort of sounds and songs to other people. I'm not doing that, but there is an REM kind of like flavour to me. Certainly Out of Time, kind of like, which is one of my favourite records. You know?
Biggest fan of Michael Stipe.
Yeah.
When I was at school, Holyrood Secondary School, we, in fifth year, Mr McLaughlin, Jack McLaughlin, was the head of the English department.
Yeah.
I'm dyslexic, so I was never good at English. I was good at English, just not going in through the eyes.
Yeah.
Easy. I was good at writing it. Coming out the other side was easy, but reading was very difficult. And he noticed that about me, but that's another story. One day we were all in class and he came in, and it's 1989, I think it was, around about 1989. Everyone's talking at the beginning of the class, the door opens and he walks in and no one's really paying attention to the teacher. And he comes in and he takes this book and he slams this like tome of a book down on his desk. The sound ricochets off the room and everyone goes quiet, and he says, "REM are the greatest rock band in the world," right? And nobody knew who, what they were, like, what, eh? And I didn't know who they were,
but
I went that day and tried to find out, you know. And I went back to my friend's house that day and his mum got the Observer at the weekend, and the supplement said REM are the greatest rock band in the world on the front cover of it.
So was that like Green?
Green,
yeah.
And that's where I became a lifelong fan. And they're still one of my favourite bands. And what they did was so original, and his voice is so original. Yeah. And a couple of times got to meet him. I mean, that's like meeting...
Did he hang out?
Yeah.
Like, wow.
I had a mad night with Michael Stipe.
I mean, you're not going to tell us, are you?
Aye.
Oh, good.
I'm not going to tell you the whole thing.
Oh, no, of course not. No.
You know.
Okay, Fran, before you tell us your Michael Stipe story, let's play the second song from The Man Who, The Fear. Fear on Tim's Listening Party on Absolute Radio. Before that song, you teased us with an anecdote about Michael Stipe.
I was meeting Colin, our old manager in LA, and he was like, "Oh, let's go and have dinner at the Chateau Marmont." I'm like, "Oh, that's good." And he drove into the car park underneath. We got out the car. This is around about the Man Who time. Get out the car and walk out, and Michael Stipe's like standing on his phone. And I went white as a sheet. And he looked at me and went, "Wait a minute." To me? And I like looked behind me going, "Me?" And he's like, "Just wait a minute, I'm on the phone." And I'm like, "All right." And I stood and waited and then got off the phone. He's like, "Oh, hi." Like, he talked to me like he knew me or something, and he'd heard the record or something. And he's like, "Here, I'm staying here, and we're maybe going out later for a drink. Do you want to come?"
Wow.
I was like, "All right, yeah." And so had dinner, went back to this house I was staying in, and waited for the call. I gave him my number, It got to like 10 o'clock, no call.
Yeah.
10:30, no call. 11, no call. Midnight, no call. I was like, that's it. I don't know if I'm allowed to say this on radio.
I don't want
to endorse like smoking drugs, but I got really stoned. Really stoned.
Put on REM and wet.
I know, I was so sad. I completely. Everybody hurts. And as soon as that happened, the phone goes and I'm like, not now. I'm not in a fit state anymore. So I picked up the phone and it was Courtney Love, and she was screaming down the phone at me going, what are you doing, blah, blah, blah. And I'd met her a couple of months earlier and she starts screaming and I'm like, what's going on? Then Michael grabs the phone, he's like, oh, we're going to go and meet for a drink, come on. And it's like 12:30, I'm off my face. And I phone up Cedric, our mate. I'm like, I'm going to meet Michael Stipe and Courtney Love. Can you come?
Please come.
He's come. So I went and I turn up and Morrissey's there as well.
Oh my God.
And I'm like, oh my God.
This does sound like a fever dream, but
it was the worst night ever. I was not in any state. They say never meet your heroes, but never ever get that stoned before you meet your heroes, because it's not going to turn out well. And I just sat quietly, sort of like kind of like vibrating for the rest of the night. But in saying that, Michael is amazing and he's like superhero. And so if you heard that in the music, that is why.
If we were going to play a song, what would you choose?
Oh, by REM?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I think I would play Driver 8, because it shows off all of their best attributes. Great rhythm track, brilliant, brilliant guitar playing by Peter Buck.
Yeah.
And it's the closest they came to like an actual traditional song. There's so many. They're one of those bands that they're a proper band.
We could talk about REM all day, but this show is about you. So let's carry on with The Fear. Yeah, I just had a note here. There's like definitely a sense of loss or longing. And the lyric that resonated with me was hottest summer in 100 years, but summer didn't bother getting up this morning. And I thought that was very poetic and beautiful.
And it was the hottest summer
that
time, because that was all in the news. And it didn't. I was heartbroken, you know. You need to get it out of your system. That whole period of time, remember, Doug, like my granddad died as well.
Yeah.
And it was like, but it was a watershed moment. You know, it's like they say that a door closes, another one opens. And if none of that had happened, we'd never have moved to London.
But it was that period where you'd come round to the house. You know, you'd come round, we'd have a gin and tonic and be kind of chatting away, and then you'd be like, oh, I've got another song.
Yeah.
And it would be like every week there'd be another
excitement levels going on.
Two or three new songs that you're going, writing to reach you was, I was like, that's the best thing you've done. That is amazing.
Yeah.
And I remember when you wrote Love, because I was going out with Katrina's best friend at this time, Anna, and she dumped me as well. So we were both
in
heartbreak mode.
Yeah.
And then he came around and played Love, and I was just weeping. You know? And it was just, you know, it was that time where just songs were just pouring out. It was amazing.
Amazingly fruitful period.
And before bands, and this is before you were in the band.
Before I'd even joined, yeah.
Dougie, like, has been... talk about like someone who's a champion. I remember some of the things, I never still don't forget some of the things that you said to me around about that time, because I'm just not very confident ever, still not. You just think everything you do is that's it. But that's another story for another time. But eventually you get your confidence up about whatever. But Doug would be like, I remember we were listening to a Radiohead song or something, and you were like, mate, you're as good as that. You could be as good, you know, you were so encouraging.
I think, you know, if you're open and sensitive and you're tuning into something that not everyone can do.
Yeah, yeah.
You need a friend who can just sort of say, this is brilliant, you know.
You need batteries.
Yeah, you need someone with their arm around you.
Yeah, yeah.
Time for another song. Let's play the next song from the man who it's As You Are. As you are. Let's talk about that last song, As You Are. Do you think the majority of boys in bands are different than other boys? That's my question to you, Fran. Because I think one of the lyrics is not like all the other boys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, like, all through, I always felt like I had a sign on my back saying, kick me. And I think, for whatever reason, you attract the bullies, you attract people that are going to knock the lumps out you just right. because you look a little bit waifish, or you just have a look. And if you've got that, you should never lose it. You can, mm-hmm. I don't even know if you can mm-hmm. lose it. Mm-hmm. It just kind of stays with you. And for better or for worse. And one of the things, though, that happens is when people do get bullied or whatever, they learn to sort of build a wall around themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to protect themselves from all the attacks coming toward them, whether it's from parents, whether it's from people, whatever. But the problem with that is if you do that, you're also blocking all the good stuff out as well. You can't right. just put up a wall.
Walls, and block. Yeah.
So it's like... The idea of this, I guess the idea of that song is embrace that vulnerability, lower your guard, because you might get hooked, but you might get kissed. Mm-hmm. You know, you might, something good might happen. Yeah, usually yeah. something does.
Yeah,
because the other side of that coin, of the bullying coin, is that you find your tribe if you keep your guard down. It's like we found each other. It's like we found our pals at art school, and it was like the creatives, if you like, uh-huh, or whatever, uh-huh. however you want to put it, they gravitate towards each other.
Yeah. Yeah,
eventually
yeah.
it's almost like a protective mechanism.
Yeah.
But and then that becomes, and then you kind of reify each other. It's self-fulfilling, and you hold each other up.
Yeah,
that's kind of the best bit of it. And that only happens if you do keep your guard there.
And the thing you were saying about not like all the other boys, mm-hmm. yes, we're
yeah.
not.
Yes, yeah. yeah.
I was saying to someone, there's maybe a few types of bands. There's like, say, a band like Oasis. That come on and they're all, because singing is inherently quite expressive.
It's vulnerability, you're exposing yourself. You really your voice are. Is you, you know.
Mm-hmm. But boys doing that, you have Oasis who are just like, they come on quite aggressively.
Yeah.
Or Idols. That yeah. guy's just like, don't come near me.
Yeah.
Or a band like me who's like a bit more like, okay. And I go the opposite way. I also go also funny. I'll be silly or something. Uh-huh. And that's my defence.
Yeah.
Again, like I say, there's people who write jokey songs. But we are. And I think that's a little, like you say, a little tribe of roofish, sensitive young men.
I remember when you came round to the house, we were in downstairs in the living room, played As You Are.
Mm-hmm.
You were like that. I think this one might be about me. And I was like, they're all about you.
That's right, I remember that. I'm like, oh God. Oh no.
It's an incredibly emotive vocal.
Yeah.
This one.
Yeah. Yeah, every day I wake up alone because I'm not like all the other boys. I like, ever since a long time, that's the last, I love the last verse. There's a lovely little chord twist. Ever since a long time, I felt the rain. There was no danger, no more strangers, as you are. No danger, no more strangers. Again, talking about my lost love or whatever. And this idea of feeling the lowering the guard and feeling all the hard feelings but also all the good feelings, because you really only, you know, your life's a flash in the pan.
Yeah.
You're a long time in the ground.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, when you stub your toe, you really feel alive even though it's painful. And so you got to remember these things, because a lot of people are checked out.
Yeah.
Mm. You know, and you've watched them wandering around the streets and you're like, wow. And now you've got these phones and everyone's just like there and you're like, God, look at this. No one's looking. There's so much cool stuff going around, you know.
So I was making notes and I put this Glockenspiel in this one and a really great guitar break around 2 minutes 40. Then it's all brought down again, like the ending of a very open-ended film.
Mm-hmm.
Which takes us into the next song, Driftwood, and I think is one of the first lines, or it might be the first line, that says, everything is open.
Yeah.
Before we talk about it, let's hear the classic Driftwood. Watching bridges burn, your driftwood floating underwater, breaking into pieces, pieces, pieces. Just driftwood, hollow end of no use. Waterfalls and fire. That was track four from The Man Who, Driftwood. I mean, I was going to say earlier that As You Are was my favourite song, but Driftwood is my favourite song on the album, so can you tell me a lot about that, please?
Sure. I remember we'd finished the record, right?
Yeah. And then Driftwood was the last thing, wasn't it?
It was the last thing. I was living in Crouch End at the time, in this tiny wee house sandwiched between all the big houses. And the door goes, and it's our managers coming in. They looked quite somber. we had a few weeks before the first single was even going to come out. They sat me down and they're like, we need a couple more singles, you know, that conversation. Yeah, yeah, the difficult, yeah. We need, yeah, a single, yeah, conversation. Yeah. And I was like, all right. And so they delivered that message and off they went. And then I started to try and write. And I mean, as you'll know, 98, 99% of the time, everything you do, I mean, is ultra I mean, it's dog It comes out and you're like, it is literally like, you have to clear the drains. And then I was talking to someone the other day about songwriting, and I love that film, There Will Be Blood. Mm. That bit at the beginning where Daniel Day-Lewis is down that hole, just digging. And I don't think songwriting's artistic in any way, shape or form. Mm-hmm. Apart from the last 2%, that's the artistic part. Most of it's just digging and digging and digging. And eventually you might just find a wee tiny bit of something, a wee bit of gold that you bring to the surface and go, oh, look, and you make something out of it. But most of it's digging. And so I dug and I dug and I dug. I had this little tape recorder and it was 120 minutes long and it automatically flipped.
Yeah.
When it finished recording on one side to the other, I was downstairs washing the dishes. I recall this thing. I was watching Cheers and Norm overheard his boss in the toilets saying that they were going to get rid of all the driftwood in the office. And I just recalled that from the TV show and I was off, you know, doing the dishes and I went, yeah, driftwood, do, 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 do. And it just came out and I went, oh, that's good. And ran upstairs, pressed record, sort of wrote it down, and the doorbell went and it was Andy. Mm. And went down and hung out with Andy for a couple of hours, came back up and I was like, oh, I recorded something. And here I did that thing where you press pause and it's not pause.
You'd press pause instead of record,
yeah,
right?
Right. So so when I thought I paused it, I'd press record. So you just have me walking away from I didn't record it. I had no idea what it was. Yeah. You hear me going down the stairs, you hear Andy coming in the distance. And we're playing REM. We played Receiving Departments, 4 a.m. Stuck Day Sleeper.
Yeah, it's a great
Day Sleeper had just come out. We're now, okay, we can hear it downstairs. Well, Andy then goes away, and this tape's running for like an hour and whatever. The tape flips. I come back up, and I thought, oh, I can hear, and I know what's happened. And at the very, very end of the tape, with maybe 10 seconds to go, you hear me walking back up the stairs to come and to listen to what or at least that's what I thought. And then I turn around and walk back down the stairs, and just as I do that, away in the distance, I sung it again.
You would never have remembered it.
No, ever. No, no, it was just, otherwise it would never exist. So I did it and got it all together and wrote it that night and woke up in the middle of the night going, I need to write another verse, which I never do. I'm very lazy. You know, you do verse one, chorus, verse two, chorus, repeat verse one. You know what I mean? No one cares. But in this case, I thought there needs to be another, because it's everything is open. Nothing is set in stone. So everything and nothing. The second verse is nobody is an island. Everyone, so nobody and everyone. Mm-hmm. And I was like, there has to be another every and nothing, you know, that sort of thing. And it was the only last one in the dictionary was everywhere and nowhere. And that was, and so I wrote a verse around that sort of thing. Everywhere there's trouble, nowhere safe to go. Every time I sing that song, even today, that last verse is still relevant. Because everywhere there's trouble, it just seems like we're still trying to figure out how to
human condition
having some peace and quiet, you know. But yeah, I love that song too.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And what a great story behind it. I'm glad that you managed to remember it. So, Fran, Dougie, I noticed that the album's produced by Nigel Godrich, with the exception of some Mike Hedges stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in Mike because I met him.
Yeah.
And he was at our studio, Mono Valley, or that's, we claimed it as our studio, in the 90s, and he brought Lush with him to just come and visit and sort of have a drink and stuff like that. But he seemed like a really decent guy.
Yeah.
Well, and obviously The
Mike
Cure
was lovely,
and,
yeah.
You know.
He was great. Well, with The Writing to Reach You, actually, we tried to record that for the first record. I've just remembered.
Yeah.
Remember Steve that Lillewell. Night? We tried to record it.
Wow.
And we couldn't do it.
Wow.
We just couldn't do it.
No drugs involved at all.
No, none at all.
Just none. We never touched just, that, any of that nonsense.
Divine timing, I think.
But when we went to Mike's place in France, the Chateau de la Rougemont, Redhead, funnily enough.
Yes.
We did Writing to Reach You, we did Rain. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Turn.
And
as well. Turn.
The recording was great. Mike was great. He was he hadn't been very well, so he was a little bit distant in a way, but he's a brilliant guy. Lovely man.
Yeah,
and really amazing vocals. That's his kind of real genius.
Comping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like none of the for instance, the vocal on Rain, the vocal on Turn, is like a comp from about 20 different takes of vocals. You would never know it. I mean, it's the biggest cheat ever. But there's no auto-tune. That's the thing about Mike. He would never use auto-tune or any weirdness like that. He would just try and pick the absolute best moments, not the obvious moments.
Yeah.
And he was just, wow.
But that is a real art, isn't it? Because, I mean, you know, I've worked with people who have, like, done it so meticulously that it becomes, certainly in my head, quite flat, you know, and you need the big things and, you know, it's a good balance.
Yeah.
So it's a really good art. And it's an art form.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, that precision, but then what you're talking about the kind of the atmospheres, kind of, that's Nigel. Like the kind of the atmosphere of the record.
It's very filmic. Kind of, I know it's an overused word, but cinematic.
Nigel was just, he was, when we got back to London and started working with Nigel, the sonic palette for the record started to really take shape, because he was flying pretty high after OK Computer. That was his thing.
Okay.
So he brought in just his expertise in making things, I don't know, having sonically creating an emotional response that kind of married well with the songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
And getting us in the room. That's Nigel's thing. He's like, that's, if there's any trick, is just put the band in the room and have them play together. There's and very little overdubbing, very little EQ on the desk.
Yeah.
He'd have a flat desk and he'll go listen to the drums and he's got this little muscle in his jaw.
Yeah.
That pulses, right? That's all.
We need to know that. That's
you're always sitting behind your producer or your engineer, and you see these little things, and this little thing starts to move, and then he gets up and goes in. You know, if you're sound checking the kit, and he'll move the mic about, you know, a centimeter to the left, or right, or up or down. Come back in and listen again. And the little muscle starts to twitch, and then he goes back out, and he'll do this about maybe five times or six times, and until he gets, and that's how he EQs. It's mic position.
Wow!
All mic position.
Wow!
Right?
Wow!
And then moves on to the next thing, and it's all done on tape as well, because it was before Pro Tools.
Yeah.
We had to go back in and get some samples for some of the. There's a couple of noises that we couldn't get for when we were, I think when we did it live.
Mm-hmm, that's
live.
Right.
So we had to go in and get the tapes, and the guy put them all up on the thing and press play, and it was like the record. No EQ, it was flat.
Wow.
He's so talented. We get so fortunate that Nigel did that record or worked with us, because he's amazing. And we were very, very lucky, very fortunate.
Yeah.
We would not be here today, I don't think.
But it's really exciting that he came off OK Computer and then into yours, because, you know, it'll have been like flying high, I suppose, and sort of like, you know, we'll have tried a million things, and then we had that actually with the Flood coming off Actung Baby.
And
he went straight into our second album, and you know, I mean, I think we didn't really have enough songs, but he really helped us to put together an album, and sonically.
Yeah.
When people have come off records like that, where they've kind of, it's like they've expanded the
palette. Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
And they've got all these new things that they want to keep doing or try, and it's very exciting. Yeah.
New gear as well.
Yeah, exactly. Nigel was super exciting to work with.
Wow. Yeah. All right, let's continue this listening party with track number 5, The Last Laugh of the Laughter. Travis with The Last Laugh of the Laughter. Dougie, I noticed a bass solo around the 2-minute mark.
That was good fun. I like that. It was like, was it you or Knives that went, go and do something like Adam Clayton would do? You're like, do like the U2 thing. And I was like,
bam,
bam, bam, bam, bam. And I was like, all right. Just, we were in Rack Studio 2, you know, the one with the stairs.
Right,
that's where we did that one. And so I just wandered downstairs and just was like, I think I did it twice. Just like that. Went in like, bam, bam, bam.
It's really effective because, you know, it's like, until that moment, you notice the acoustics and the vocals and stuff like that. And then
totally off the cuff. And it was, then I went up and I was like, any good? And they were like, yeah, great, that's fine. I was like, cool, all right. But again, the sonic texture, I was just going back to Driftwood. I've just remembered I had my album Whitey on Driftwood. Everybody gets an album Whitey. And mine was playing the glass harmonica, which is just like wine glasses, like tuned wine glasses. And Nigel was like, right, you've got to just do it, but it's got to be absolutely consistent through the whole thing. There was no sampling it, no kind of like looping it. He said, you've got to just go out and play it. So I was just there. Kind of for, it felt like hours, just sweat blinded me, going, oh, beep. It was like absolute madness.
Wow.
But we got there in the end, but God almighty, it was tough. And I was like, you can barely hear it after all.
If it wasn't there, you'd miss it, though.
Yeah, exactly. Textures.
So we actually recorded an EP at Rack.
So you would have been there when Mickey was alive?
I know, because like I sat next to him and I think it was Blue Jean by David Bowie came on, and I don't know what was going on about really, but I was fascinated by Mickey Mouse, and you know, and he was just saying, whatever happened to Bowie? He used to be so cool. And it's like, and it's like, it seems pretty cool now, but I mean,
Love Mickey. He was always, what was his sign off line? He'd come in, say hi, and then have a little chat, and then he just got that, I'll see you in the charts.
Wow, that is gold. Okay, so the next track is a track that maybe lots of people have not heard before. It's called Turn.
Turn was written way before any. That's a really early song. And as you know, if you've never got enough songs, we always just go out in the studio and just try.
Oh, yeah, you've got
and,
to have some more, yeah. It's like,
you know, you're looking through under things. I'm sure I had another song.
The
somewhere.
Song down the back of the sofa.
Yeah, this was definitely the song down the back of the sofa. And it was written around the same time as All I Want to Do Is Rock. I went to Millport, which is a wee island, solely to write. We didn't have a deal.
Yeah.
We were struggling, and I was like, I'm gonna go and write a hit song, kind of affirmating it. And I wrote All I Wanna Do Is Rock, and I wrote Turn. And Turn, so the lyrics kind of like, I was close to my granddad, and he'd always have all these wishes, you know?
Yeah.
And so the song's full of all these kind of like, I want to see this, I want to do that, I want to be forever young.
Forever young, yeah.
Yeah, I want to see the kingdom come. I was brought up a Catholic. Mm. I'm not a Catholic anymore, but it was like sci-fi, right? You know, it's like, it's kind of a bit sci-fi. And it sounds a bit like a hymn as well, Turn. So it's the closest I think we've got to a hymn. So then we recorded it with Mike Hedges.
Right.
And it was a disaster.
Right.
Although the only thing we kept was the vocal, because its vocal sounds amazing because Mike did his magic on it.
I mean, it is such a transition from the verse to the chorus.
And, yeah, it, you know, really, I mean, takes, like, off.
Yeah.
So we got surprised. Andy Mack took us into Abbey Road with Mike, who is Abbey Road alumni or whatever. Mm-hmm. That's where he cut his teeth. We went into, what was it?
Studio 2.
We were the Beatles room.
Wow, yeah.
And we were just like, oh my God, this is amazing. It was just like...
That was great.
But could we record a single note? Nope. Everything we recorded in it was...
Yeah. I remember at one point we got so desperate that you just went down to stand in the middle of the room and just sing the song a cappella with no music. Mm-hmm. And it was just... I just remember sitting next to Mike and it was just... You were belting it out in the middle of the room and Mike just went... It's so sad.
Like, you just couldn't nail it.
It was a nightmare.
It was terrible.
And
we came out of there with nothing. Yeah. Nothing, not a single thing. And we were in for 2 weeks.
Wow. Right? Wow.
And I felt terrible because Andy Mack and the record company had paid all money for the studios.
And then Nigel came to the rescue.
Yeah.
Because it's a super simple song. Uh-huh. I mean, it's all about that kind of the soaring chorus.
Yeah.
The vocal just kind of takes off.
Yeah.
So everything else in it is super simple.
Yeah.
And you know what it's like, that sometimes they're the hardest things to get right.
Yeah.
Because they just, it's getting everything to fit together when there's not much there.
Yeah.
You know, it's really, that was really tough. And that was where Nigel came in. He kind of made it.
Did he make you feel a bit more like less conscious and...
It just made it.
He mixed it.
He just made it feel like, oh, there's actually those simple blocks that were there.
Oh, so he didn't have to re-record.
He just glued it all together.
He excavated it out of the rock of that it was. Wow. It was like solid. And he did. He just like got his like drill out and just drilled it, and it's in there somewhere. Like this beautiful thing that was like this soaring vocal, and he was very fond of the Echoplex, and so the snare has this this kind of thing going on. He might have done an overdub of a brain of the.
I think we did a few bits and pieces. Yeah.
I mean, you got to remember, we were on our last legs. Good Feeling had come out. We toured with everybody. We toured with Oasis. We were like going on and couldn't get arrested. Mm-hmm. And here was this album of incredibly slow songs.
Mm-hmm.
And we went, had an interview with Mark Beaumont of the NME.
Yeah.
And Mark was, you know, his usual kind of acerbic, kind of
I know
cheeky,
Mark. Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
I love his honesty as well. And at the end of the interview, he's like that guy. So he switched off the tape. He's like, I love the album. It's commercial suicide.
Wow.
And I was like, at that point we were like, we need to pack our bags, we'll go back to Glasgow and that'll be the dream over. And I don't know, you know, it's just how things turn out.
And speaking of how this turned out, let's hear that track we've just been speaking about, Turn. Track number 6 on The Man Who, the classic Turn. Up next is another classic. Tell me about Why Does It Always Rain on Me?
I mean, we were so convinced that that album was going to do nothing, like nothing, that I was in with Andy Mack talking about what's going to be the next single after Driftwood.
What did they feel like, you know, the label?
Andy was amazing. He never stopped believing.
Yeah.
I'd given up and everyone else had given up, but Andy was just kept going and going and going. We had this funny conversation of what's the next single after Driftwood. It was Writing to Reach You, Driftwood, what's the next single? And it got so desperate, this is embarrassing, I was like, Andy, this is my pitch, Wimbledon, and it's going to rain, it always rains at Wimbledon, and we can pitch it to the BBC and they'll play it and then people will get to hear it, because we didn't think we'd get played on the radio at all.
Right.
And he was like, okay, yeah, that's a good idea. Like, as if that was an idea at all.
Because I remember having a conversation with their manager at the time. He was going, oh, let's talk about Why Does It Always Rain being the the next single. And I was like, yeah, it's pretty catchy, it's pretty commercial. And he was like, nobody wants to listen to a bloody pop star moaning about the weather.
I know.
I was like, oh dear.
And then, obviously, Wimbledon came and went. It didn't rain.
Right. but he did at Glastonbury, right?
He did at Glastonbury. Yeah. And that was that moment. And I'm sure you've had shows where you guys have gone on stage. The bands are not the best judge of what is a good show and what's a bad show. But we came off from that gig. It was the 4 o'clock slot on the other stage.
Yeah.
We did our gig. And we came off at the end and it rained and everybody was miserable in the audience. And I was like, oh, this was the moment where I'm like, it's truly over, we're done. And people were patting us in the back as we were coming off stage. Like,
right.
Better luck next time, lads, oh, no. Type of thing.
I thought it was in like with triumph.
No,
Well, you get more than a pat on the back.
It was the consoling pat on the back.
Yeah. It was 10-0 defeat. And went home and got into the flat, opened the door, turned on the telly, and you know when the old tellies would heat up? And as I'm walking back to the sofa, I heard my name come out the telly. And I was like, what? Did I just hear something there? Am I just like having oral hallucinations? And I turn around, John Peel, Joe Wiley are sitting around the campfire with their wellies on, going, Travis, the band of the festival.
Wow.
And I was like, that was one of the worst gigs we've ever played. What are they saying? And so let's have a look. And they showed us playing All I Want to Do Is Rock. And it was amazing. I was like watching another band. And it's, you know, when... Again, and this is so nice to talk to someone who is in a band and yeah. Totally gets it.
Yeah.
There's a moment in a band's thing where everything just clicks together. Yeah. Everyone's in, and especially the singer, you're in this other zone. You go into mm-hmm. this mad sort of dialed in zone.
Yeah.
And I saw it. I was like, whoa, who the hell is he?
Yeah.
I didn't know him.
Yeah.
And then you impersonate him forevermore.
I think, you know, like listening to Turn as well, going back to that one, you know, to me, I was thinking this morning that you kind of like are a vessel and you've got this like thing going on and you transform into like a superhero.
Yeah.
You know, and is that the kind of thing that you saw on the telly?
Yeah. Especially, so we're talking about Turn, but All I Want to Do Is Rock, similar kind of song. It's heavy. There's this big scream going on in it. That thing of letting go that much to... sing that loud and go for it.
It does
something to you.
You just
get totally like, I don't know what's going on, but it's something pretty cool.
And then when you walk off stage, how do you feel? Are you still the same, or as a person on stage, or you go straight back to
you're you again?
Yeah,
it's like you get possessed by something.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, you know, whatever that thing is,
it's letting your id out. Yeah. Ego and id. It's like the internal kind of id is like the basic kind of primal self, and the ego is like the presentation that you give to the world,
the edited version
of that id. And when you let that out, which is why, going back to what, like being the voice, being the self in a way, it's why people sing in groups,
because
there's the protection of the crowd. They can sing as loud as they want at football or church or you know, at a show. And it's like this primal need to let that out. But you don't have to give yourself away because you've got the protection of numbers. Singing's a special thing.
All right, it's time to hear that timeless track. Why Does It Always Rain On Me? That's Why Does It Always Rain On Me from the Travis album, The Man Who. The next song is called Love, spelled L-U-V.
Yeah.
Nice harmonica.
Do you want me to send you the demo to that?
I'd love a copy, yeah.
Yes, because it is so... We got a publishing deal before we got a record deal. quite a long, like a year and a half before, or a year before.
Do you find it helpful?
Because our gear was rubbish. We had no equipment, so we had the worst guitars, the worst amps. When we were doing our demos, we went into Riverside Studio.
When the Fannies were there?
Yeah, and Norman and Jerry.
Oh, Norman.
Love those guys.
We were like recording our sort of demo. We had the publishing deal. We just hadn't had any money to buy any equipment yet, so we're still playing with all this rubbish equipment. And Norman, the guys came in and they're like, "All right, yeah, what are you doing?" And we're like, "Oh my god!" And they were in there with Alex Chilton rehearsing. So it was just like we were going. I mean, I knew who Alex Chilton was.
That's cool.
You know, at least that was something. But they gave us their gear, so they rehearsed during the day, and in the evenings they would give us their Vox amps. They're brilliant, like. Guitars, just hit, there you go, lads. Just don't break them.
Or sell them.
and would let us play, and all our demos just suddenly got up like that. And I went to London, and so we recorded it on tape with this our friend Adam Seymour, who was the guitarist in the Pretenders at the time. And Charlie Pinder at Sony had put me and him together to record my demos a bit better. We'd recorded that, and he's like, "Oh, maybe needs a harmonica. You ever played harmonica?" And I was like, "No." And he's like, "Do you want to try?" And I was like, "Sure."
Yeah.
And he gave me the harmonica, and that was I did it first stop. I never touched it. I was like Midnight Cowboy, and he was just like, and as I was doing it, I'm going, How's this possible? I've never touched this instrument before. And it got recorded. And so that I'll send it along. Yeah. It's lovely and it's fragile, and that's the one I sent to that girl.
Actually, literally have the blues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I really had it then, but that's the one I sent to that girl, and not a peep.
Unbelievable.
Not a peep.
Well, let's hear what she's missing out on. This is called Love. So, Fran, the penultimate track, She's So Strange. Girl with a moustache, cat sniffing glue, Birmingham.
Yeah.
I wrote, it's a story within a story. Is that right? What do you say that?
I'd just seen Psycho, and that's in it.
Right.
I was born in Stafford. It's one of the only songs I think I've ever written that was more just made up fictional, like a story, like you say.
And we were talking, about joke things, sort of like to be protective, to have something throwaway. Would you say that that's one of these occasions? Maybe?
Yes. Yeah. It wasn't supposed to be in the record. It's literally one of the first songs.
Right.
That wasn't even down the back of the couch.
That was in the bin.
It was getting picked up by the penny. And it turned out great. And I remember being in Abbey Road with Nigel, cutting it with Chris Blair, the late Chris Blair, in the cutting room, cutting the record, mastering the record. Nigel's like, again, the little muscle in his jaw started to twitch, and I'm like, "Oh God, what's this?" And then the muscle goes, and then the crease happens.
Right.
Like he kind of creases his face up, and you're like, "Oh, something."
Such a telling face.
He's about to cut something out here. Right. And he cut out two verses of that song. That song was really long.
Right.
And then he whipped it out, like two verses, and in the mastering session, and made it a lot better.
Yeah.
But it's the weakest song in the album, but somehow I like it because of the end part where it goes all dreamy and weird and spacey, and Birmingham's in it, and Birmingham, I've got a big place in my heart for Birmingham.
I really like She's So Poor and Only Now She's Looking Back, sees the story on a paperback, what will become of her, there's not much left for her.
Yeah.
I thought that was lovely.
It's very Beatley. It's a very Beatly. It's got a bit of She's Leaving Home to it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and especially when it was the longer version, it felt like a play or something, like a, like very much a kind of story song, and you're kind of following this little journey. I mean, I know what you're saying about it being the weakest song on the record, but there's a lot of things about it that I like. I think it's just the Beatliness of it is kind of right there. And when it goes into that dreamy section at the end, it's like the... Or the harmonies, the kind of three-part harmonies, kind of make...
That's great.
It underlines the Beatles-iness.
Yeah, agreed.
I would definitely take it off the record, though, if I had a choice.
There's always one, though, isn't there? There's always going to be one, at least. At least.
I'd let it slip down the side of the couch again.
Someday else to find it.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to listen to it anyway. Here's track 9 on The Man Who, She's So Strange. And while the cats are all sniffing, that was She's So Strange by Travis on Absolute Radio. So, the last song, Slideshow. Mention of Wonderwall again?
Yeah, well, so the album opens with Wonderwall.
Yeah, mention of Devil's Haircut.
Yeah.
Like that.
The songs
I bought that in Birmingham, actually.
Yeah?
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's, so the album opens with what's... Because when I wrote Writing to Reach You, that was 95, we'd seen Oasis playing at Tina Park for the first time that year. That was a big, big when that band cut through, and we went to a bar after it, and Noel Gallagher walked in looking like he was in the Velvet Underground. He had a Ready Brett glow around him. He was like, oh, it was like, he's a rock star.
Yeah.
And that was like, you felt like... So cut to 6 months later, and I'm sitting in the coldest flat in Glasgow, and I'm writing this song, and I'm nicked his chords, because that's the chords to Wonderwall in Writing to Reach You.
Okay.
But I thought, God.
But there's a really nice like key change, though, or sort of like
Baccarat
key kind of style thing.
Yeah. However, the verse chords are absolutely lifted massively.
I had no idea.
As we do, and as he does. And in a million years, I thought I'm never going to meet Noel Gallagher in a million years, because I'm on the dole, nothing's going to happen. But in the off chance, I should mention a little nod in case he hears it.
Yeah.
And he was like, all right, okay. It's a little tap of the doff of the cap to the originator. So I did that. It's What's a Wonderwall anyway, because I've nicked your chords. Thanks, Noel. And we end up like a year and a half later touring with them. And Noel come up to me and after we came off stage, and he went, nice cause, mate. And I'm like, oh, I thought he was going to hook me.
But, are we okay?
Yeah. But that was that. And then so the final song in the thing is it's a song about songs.
Yeah.
It's the song about, like, you know, we can get wrapped up in pop bands and pop stars and forget what it is about songs that's important, which are like songs are bookmarks in our lives. Mm-hmm. Songs penetrate deeper than any other art form. It's like pouring water it goes all the way in to your soul, and that's what the song's about. You know, it's like you close your eyes and it's no longer about a Devil's Haircut song or a Wonderwall or a Oasis or whatever. It's about your own life, it's about your memories. Yeah. And you close your eyes and you'll maybe remember people who are no longer with you, or you'll remember times that you had great something, like a summer that when you were 12, that you just, that song, when you hear it, just takes you back there and you're filled with whatever it was, that feeling from the time. So that's kind of what that song's about. The recording of it...
Oh, that's right, the car.
Yeah, I'll pass over.
No, go for it, because
you were not in the car.
I wasn't in the car.
Right, so we decided, because Nigel being Nigel, like let's try and do this a different way. So I had a little mini, and I was like, let's just record it in the mini.
Yeah.
We'll just drive around, and he got a DAT recorder with a stereo two AKG microphones on a sort of thing, and he had his headphones on, sitting in this tiny mini, and I'm trying to play it, and in the end it was just too loud. The car was just like rah, rah. But every time we would pull up to the lights and some other car would pull up and the driver of the taxi or whatever would look over and be like, what's going on in this car? There's a guy all crushed in with a guitar and this dolt with headphones on. And in the end we used Neil's car, and at the beginning of that song you hear Nigel telling Neil to open the car door and shut it. You got to open it and
shut it.
Nigel getting his belligerent inner child escaping. And it's beautiful. And Sally, who we've always used to do all of our strings for all of our albums.
Yeah, cello, is it?
Sally Herbert. Yeah. She made this lovely string arrangement for it. I think it's one of my favourite, one of our songs as well. And so, yeah. A good way to sort of end the record. Yeah.
Great way to end today as well.
Thanks,
like
Tim.
To say thanks so much.
Thanks, Tim.
Dougie, Fran.
Pleasure.
It's been
very interesting, and what a great record.
Have you ever done this for one of your records?
I actually did. I replaced myself with Danielle from Absolute, and sat where you are and talked about telling stories, and it was
that's cool.
Just like a roller coaster of like emotional turmoil, but it's fun though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Thanks for the opportunity, man.
Oh, pleasure. Thanks for coming. Let's finish by hearing the final track on The Man Who. It's called Slideshow. For the sake of dead air, we're just going to fast forward straight to the hidden track that comes after Slideshow, Blue Flashing Light.
Now everyone sees and yet nobody says, are we all just afraid of the heat? But it's Saturday night and I'm lying alone in the bed that I made, disconnected the phone, still they never called you, no never called you, no they never called, never called.
That Slideshow and the hidden track Blue Flashing Light, concluding the listening party on Absolute Radio. Thank you to Fran Healy and Dougie Payne for taking me through The Man Who. Every listening party, I like to recommend a few records that I've been listening to this past week. I was really excited to hear that Julia Holter had a new album, and the album's called Something in the Room She Moves. It's out right now. And the song that I've been listening to the most is Spinning. It's gorgeous. I recommend you all buy it. Been seeing a lot of Joni Mitchell news, and she's back on Spotify now after a 2-year protest. And the first track I went to was a track on the album Hegira, and the song is called Song for Sharon. Next up, Wise Blood. Again, I'm a huge fan, and this is not a recent album. I've just been sort of like going back and listening to Titanic Rising, and the song I'm going to recommend is Picture Me Better. Definitely must be going through a singer-songwriter phase this week. Next up is Robert Wyatt, and the song is Shipbuilding. It's a classic. You probably all know it, but if you don't, check it out. It's gorgeous. Replay any past episodes of my listening party by searching and following Tim's Listening Party wherever you get your podcasts. Catch up on the Libertines from last week and every episode we've done so far. Sparks, The Bangles, Texas, U2, The Kinks, Def Leppard, and many more. We may be at the end of the show, but keep tweeting me your thoughts using the hashtag Tim's Listening Party. Every song in this episode of my listening party was taken from Travis's The Man Who. All tracks are written by Fran Healy. The album was released on Independiente, May 1999. I'm Tim Burgess, and thanks for listening. I'll see you soon for another listening party.
Absolute Radio. Telling the story behind another iconic album with Tim Burgess.
Get involved using the hashtag Tim's Twitter Listening Party.